Welcome back to Open Source Underdogs, the podcast where we get you into the middle of open source business models. Our guest today is Tyler Jewell, CEO of WSO2 and a partner in Toba Capital, a Bay Area VC fund. Tyler does a pretty good job of explaining what WSO2 is about, so let's just dive right into it. Tyler, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about your background. You worked for Oracle, Quest, Veritas, BEA. How'd you get here? And what did you find so exciting about the opportunity to lead WSO2?
Well, I started off my career with a degree in computer science. I had a very short-lived career as an engineer. Wasn't all that good with that. But got this amazing exposure to enterprise software, spending 6 years at BEA in various product-related roles. And that really led to a career in product management and got exposure to, you know, different companies and different products, usually related to developers, middleware, integration, DevOps, and successively worked on projects of different complexity and scale. And that really helped build a global view of markets, products, and how you move those products through those markets. And through accident, more than anything, while I was at Quest Software and doing product management, they had a view of markets, which were a combination of mergers and acquisitions, investments, and product management in the classic sense. And I got invited to work on a variety of corporate development activities, a few acquisitions, some divestitures, and for a while leading their investment portfolio. And once you start wandering into corporate development, you really develop a broader view of markets, and you start to look at things about how do I help develop the market? And there's lots of ways to do that besides just building products. And that just gives you a completely different perspective on the ecosystem, how businesses are built. And that opened up all kinds of other opportunities for me. I started doing board work. I had done angel investments, corporate investments. And over the years, I put about $100 million of venture capital and money to work in various companies, all related to DevOps. You know, that got me opportunities at Oracle and eventually allowed me to form the hypothesis on why I started CodeEnvy. And it was never a goal for me to become a CEO, but just the opportunity was so exciting and people were asking me to lead it and go forward with it. And next thing you know, you're the CEO of a company. And CodeEnvy and the investments were just a wonderful experience over 6 years. And when CodeEnvy was sold to Red Hat last year, the founders of WSO2, which I had been on the board for almost 8 years, were ready to focus on being technical founders, like the relationship that we had, and asked me to come on board here. So it's just been really one thing after the other. There's been no particular vision in mind other than good technology, good people, and kind of developing markets.
So WSO2 has created a number of successful enterprise integration software platforms. How do you think that making these platforms open source enhances the business?
I feel like that open source is this important trade-off that you make. By opening your source code, you are creating an environment of visibility and transparency that should lead to community in all sorts of ways that you can't even anticipate in the beginning. So that if you can put value on some definition of the community through that transparency, then it's a good trade-off to make. When you're dealing with investors, I tell investors, look, open source really is supposed to bring investors two key attributes. The first is that if the investors are paying for the intellectual property to be developed, and then the company gives up some of these rights by putting an open source license on it, then in exchange for that, they should get a significantly higher rate of distribution on their software products, right? If it's available and there's limited restrictions on access, there better be paired with some sort of mechanism by which you get 100, 1,000, or 10,000x the distribution. And that's meaningful because it should generate a lot more opportunities for you to sell your value than it would have otherwise. And then the second thing is that there is this unwritten implied contract between the open source vendor and its community, in that the community, whether they realize it or not, because they have access and rights to the software, they do take on some implied obligation of evaluating the software a little bit more thoroughly without depending upon the vendor's resources. So there should be overall a much lower cost of sale because more of this evaluation process can be done without the vendor having to commit resources to do it. So from an investment point of view, those two qualities really should materialize, and obviously that should lead to a good rate of return.
So WSO2 has several products, and I guess each product has its own specific value proposition. But do you think that there's an Uber value proposition that is common among WSO2 products?
The perception is that WSO2 does have a number of different products, but we play in a single market, which is the integration market. And the integration market has really defined itself to be API-driven over the past few years. So you don't do integration unless you're going to package it up into some sort of API. And so every product that the company has is really tailored around this narrative on what an integration platform needs to take in order to deliver on this API-driven vision. And so you start with APIs, you then need API management. In order to build the APIs, you need to have an integration backbone. So that's an ESB and message broker. And then you need to secure all that. And that's how we get to the identity space. So the company for a long time was very technically oriented. And so it positioned a lot of these things as separate individual components, but all the components were really designed around this common integration narrative. And, you know, over time, I think the company's gotten better about how to communicate that.
What does open source mean to you? Is it just licensing the code under an open source license, or does it mean something more?
Open source to me is a commitment to openness more than anything. I think that the phrase open source, it is too easily implies a licensing model associated with that. But if you're really going to call yourself an open source business, you need to have a commitment to openness. And when you commit to openness, this creates a level of transparency that allows you to get a level of trust with your potential customers. And when you have a higher degree of trust, your interests become more aligned along the way. And so while I think that most companies start off by just looking at this as a licensing mechanism, they can put it out there and you get this kind of distribution exchange. If you start to see that the whole business process and the workflow around the intellectual property can be equally opened up, it just really changes the dynamic of how your prospects and your partners and your employees engage with each other and with the rest of the world. And that creates these aligned interests, which then fuel growth and profits, which are the things that businesses look for.
Not all software necessarily should be open source. What types of software do you think lend themselves to being open source?
I've certainly seen it the case where it's enterprise software, where if there is a wide spectrum of opinions on the direction that the software can go, opening that up to community is a very effective way to try to rationalize and deal with all those different perspectives. If there are lots of concerns about the configurability or the security of the software, having it be open and transparent gives almost kind of outside credibility and mitigates the risks that could come from very complicated sorts of software. So we've seen time and time again that tends to work very well when you have a consolidation of the commons, a reconciliation of wide viewpoints. Open source tends to do very well there. I'm not all that well informed about the consumer market or the prepackaged software market, but it strikes me that we've seen less success, at least commercially, with technologies that take highly shrink-wrapped products and then open source them, where consumers just expect them to work. It either works or it doesn't. It's a very binary sort of thing, and there's not a lot of engagement. I think we've seen from over time that when products fall into that very tight sort of packaging, the community doesn't give as much respect for the nature of the open source, and I don't think there's a fair equilibrium that shows up on that. So my sense is that they've done less success in that regard.
You announced that WSO2 will be launching more community-driven open source initiatives in 2019. How will these differ from WSO2-driven initiatives?
Yeah, so what's interesting is WSO2, it's 14 years old now. And when the company started a long time ago, their vision was certainly working in the integration domain, but they were building out kind of this big platform, a singular platform that was an alternative to WebSphere and WebLogic at the time. So it was really the WSO2 product. And obviously they called it a lot of things, but it was the platform essentially was the product, and it was this big thing to solve big problems. And since then, all the products that we ship are based upon this core kernel that we've got, and it's all WSO2 branded products that's there. And there's no concept of an upstream with us. So the WSO2 repository builds the WSO2 product. There's no forking. There's no branching. It's a very tight linear relationship that's there. And so people who tend to adopt our open source first have to become familiar with our brand, build some referenceability and see that we're a quality brand. And then they're willing to adopt the WSO2 product line in whatever configuration they think is fit there. So it's a very kind of a direct and linear relationship. What we've seen do very successful over the past 7 years is that the nature of marketing and how products are evaluated have shifted, and that you can take any number of critical and essential components to enterprise architecture, put them out as open source technologies and build community and transparency around those and under a different brand. It doesn't have to be your corporate brand. It can be under some project brand or whatever it may be. But the important impetus there is used by your peer group. Can you get other developers and technologists to adopt it? Can you collaborate together on those things? And through that, you gain adoption and interest. For us, we're going to be committing to more of those types of projects. And then using those components, along with components from other third-party open source providers, rolled into our products, if you will, the WSO2 branded products that we can provide support and commercial capabilities around. And so I think that good companies today have a blend of these products and projects. And WSO2 has predominantly been almost only products. We've had some projects along the way, like Ballerina and City, but we're moving towards having bigger commitment to these projects along the way, whether there are projects or third-party ones.
You don't charge for the right to use the software, so I guess you probably get this question a lot. So how does WSO2 make money?
We don't charge for the right to use the software. We sell subscriptions. Subscriptions are the mechanism by how we deliver most of our value to our customers. And subscriptions come with a couple of things. One, it gives you the right to ask us questions in development or production. It gives you an SLA. And when you're dealing with very complicated software that's powering trillions of transactions now, you need a response SLA on those particular issues. And it also includes updates. The updates are really what makes us unique. I think that we have an approach here that is unlike any other open source software company. With the updates are what you expect: patches, fixes, security issues, right? Things that were unexpected when we had released the software. But what makes us particularly unique is that when we need to do a patch or a bug fix, we still release that as open source. It's still Apache licensed. And we put that into master, and it's in the unreleased version of the repository, and it's available for anyone to get. So someone can compile that and they can put that into their environment. But the service that we provide to our customers who are on a subscription is we take that patch, we backport it specifically to your version, we convert it into a binary so that you can install just that binary and nothing else. And then we also test that binary pretty exhaustively so that we have the highest confidence level that what we're giving to you is going into that environment. So what we do for the customer is we take the patch, we backport it to the specific version for that customer, we convert it into a binary, we test that binary on environments that largely mimic that customer's environment. And so we have every level of confidence and risk mitigation that the patch that we give to the customer is going to be as meeting the needs and expectations that they've got and without disruption to them. And those binaries that we ship, those binaries are only available for those people on subscription. And that's how a big way of how we communicate that value. We get to hold to our premise, our open source principles, because everything is still technically open source in the code basis. But the value that we provide is in the work that we do with the binaries and patches and the risk mitigation of that. And our customers look at that and say, oh, you know, well, that seems like an equitable exchange of value here. We're happy to pay the subscription.
I was reading in your annual report that you have an excellent track record with customer retention. So that subscription and providing the binary updates provides an incentive for customers to renew. Any challenges around getting renewals?
If you look at our dollar-based retention rate, it's equal to MuleSoft's, which is a mostly proprietary platform on that. So we're doing well in our particular peer group. When customers churn on us, we do have some customers who just downgrade to a pure open source for whatever reason. Maybe they had budget cuts or whatnot. But we look at those not as negatives, right? I mean, I think that on a dollar basis, you can look at it and look at it as kind of a loss. But what we go into those accounts and say, look, you know, if you're going to do this, you still want to be active in the community. You can still act as a reference to us. You're still happy with the technology. You can still give us feedback. So there's still strong contributors to the community overall. And there's an immense value that comes with that, even if they're choosing not to get the updates in the SLA associated with it. And when we look at all of our churn, and every company has it, about 2/3 of our churn are companies who are sticking with us. And so it's hard for us to look at those as losses.
So one question I have is about, and I don't want to get too deep into licensing because it's a really deep topic, but sometimes customers, I get the comment that customers know how to purchase a commercial license because it comes with reps and warranties and acceptance of liability. But the open source licenses normally try to minimize liability and minimize reps and warranties. Does the subscription address some of those issues too?
Yeah, we, with our subscriptions, are we can offer different types of indemnities and warranties for customers. We do it both for the patches in the binary form that we issue and for the open source code. We have a little bit of an advantage there. We hold copyright to everything that we write ourselves on that. And so even in the situation where we get outside contributions, we take copyright and we hold clear forks so that we can maintain that and do all of our legal checks. And that sounds like a control provision, and it's not so much a control provision as more of you want to have complete and total visibility to the entire code stack so that you can patch any portion of it all the way down, even if necessary, if you need to get into the JVM or to the OS as well. Once you can demonstrate that on the legal basis and the business basis, you can start getting more flexible with the legal terms that you negotiate. And on top of that, you can make higher commitments on the SLA basis. And we've even offered at times truly abnormal response time SLAs for customers who feel the need that they need that.
One of the WSO2's priorities that you documented was to build a culture of transparency. Mm-hmm. I have to say you're living up to that. WSO2 is really transparent, I think, for a private business. Why do you think transparency is important?
I do think that transparency is really essential to our business, and we practice it in any number of ways. But I think it's fundamental in that, you know, transparency is the most effective way to get diverse groups of people with different points of view to be aligned. And it does that because when you're transparent, there is independently verifiable information. And when outsiders start to absorb that information and can verify that, it allows them to build trust much more quickly. And when two different parties have trust with one another, they're able to align their interests much more quickly and then collaborate. And this works well, not just with meritocracy with the Apache way in software products, but we found that it works well with our internal culture, with how we prepare our marketing and sales, how we treat our financials. We're actually pretty transparent about our financials outside and online, our hiring practices, our partnering practices. And so I've just found that as the larger that you get, growth really comes from the momentum that you can establish. And when you're dealing with large populations of people and product and partners and customers, you can build a lot more momentum by getting everybody's interests aligned, and transparency is the fastest way to do that.
WSO2 is hiring a lot of people. The goal said 175 people in 2019. That's almost one person per business day. What are some of the challenges that come along with this velocity of growth?
Well, the biggest challenge is you need to have a source of talent that you can work with. And we found that there are really two great ways that you can find the source of talent. First, our largest office is located in Asia, and it's in a region that has very high quality graduates in computer science and computer engineering and business. And so we're very important for us to be able to be credible and well-respected so that we can work within that community and do a big portion of our talent through that. The second is that you have to really look to everybody, all your employees. Your employees become your recruiters because it's an environment that has a certain set of ideals and principles. And they're working out in other communities that have people who reflect similar sorts of ideals. And so that becomes really essential that everybody is recruiting other people that they really respect along the way. So the source of talent is one really important thing. The second is a really challenging is culture and onboarding. In an open source company, so many of the people are mission-oriented. They work for the company because they have a high degree of aspiration to the outcome. They work on it for the love of the technology. They work on it for the brotherhood of the people that they get to work with. There's a lot of that goes on, and less so on a compensation or financial incentive basis. I think we all work for money, but this mission orientation, this mission theme is a big part of that. So when you hire on larger and larger groups of people, it becomes more challenging to get everybody aligned on that mission and for everybody to have an equal share of the commitment to the principles. And so you really have to start investing almost exponential higher rates in terms of culture as you get bigger. Otherwise, you're really going to start to fray at the edges. And then the talent that you get isn't going to stick around. You're going to have a high degree of attrition, and long-term people are going to start to lose a sense of the mission as well. So those are the two big things we face.
When you say invest in the culture, how do you invest in the culture exactly?
First, you need a really clear and concise definition of your principles and ideals. And it can't be marketing fluff. It's got to source itself from the founder's beliefs and the founder's behaviors. You then also need to have a commitment that everybody's going to live up to those principles and ideals. You have to be willing to tell people that it's okay, that if they don't believe in these particular approach or it's not comfortable for them, that it's okay, that this is maybe not the environment for them. So how do you go about doing that? Well, you've got to have a lot of materials to explain it. There's a lot of collaboration that you need to do with your tech leaders and your middle management across the company so that they can embody this and practice it. We actually incorporate our principles and philosophies into our performance review system. And that's all part of everything that we do day to day. And since we're so community driven and it needs to be focused on the mission and the theme, you have to invest a significant amount in people and things that allow people to participate in that community. So whether it's games, company all hands sessions, big office spaces that allow people the flexibility of their work schedule, whatever that is, everybody participates in the community in their own way, and you have to not make that a quibbleable budget item. That has to be kind of first on the budget. You have to put all those things in place so that those people who want to be a big part of our community, whether it's our internal or external community, have every tool and resource available to them to do that, and they can't point to anything that's holding them back on that. So that's a big part of it as well, is steering increasingly larger numbers of resources and time and focus into those activities.
Switching gears just a little bit, WSO2 recently announced some new cloud offerings, and I'm wondering if you think cloud will come to contribute more revenue than software subscriptions in the future.
You know, I think that cloud is a delivery mechanism for sure. Is it going to overtake on-prem versus not on-prem? I'm not sure that I've got a particular bias on that. What I do see happening is that cloud is definitely changing the velocity at which new services can be brought online. I see these services cropping up on-prem, in the cloud, hybrid, everywhere. And so I think we're looking at a truly hybrid world, and that services are going to be able to reside anywhere. They're going to be able to live anywhere. From our point of view, we think that that creates a wonderful integration opportunity, a lot more things that need to be brought together into a common view. Which one of those things wins, it's hard for us to say because each and every environment has such unique and different needs. But it's hard not to ignore the pure scale and size of Azure and AWS and Google, pretty impressive revenues across the board.
Has moving to cloud services created any friction in the type of business that you were? Because it seems like in the cloud business, it's about operations, whereas in the software vendor business, it's more about customer relationships and product innovation. Has there been any growing pains of moving to this cloud business?
We definitely had a lot of growing pains there. Right now, our public cloud is really just a public cloud variation of our on-prem products, right? So it's not much of a hybrid situation. The value propositions are largely the same in that regard. I think that what we've really figured out is that in order to run a public cloud, we had to operate our products in ways that we never operated them before. And that in turn caused us to redesign a lot of basic primitives in our products related to updates, configuration management, operations, and whatnot. And that in turn has actually been one of the big reasons why we've had the kind of growth over the past couple of years, because 35% of our customers are running our products, even though it's an on-prem version of our product, they're running it in a cloud style. So we basically ate our own dog food, and going through that process actually caused us to rethink all sorts of things at the end of the day. So that was probably the biggest benefit we got.
What's a typical sales cycle? Do people find the open source and then call you? Or is WSO2 more active in generating business?
We're more of an inbound business, believe it or not, because we put our technology out there. We evangelize it pretty aggressively. So customers tend to approach us, and they've already got a project in mind for that. And they approach us through one of two ways. About a third of our customers approach us through a partner, so a system integrator or a reseller that they're already working with. And a lot of those partners are equally committed to open source, right? So we are their open source vendor of choice in that regard. And then other customers have architects and VPs of engineering who have been designing systems, and they see that we could fill a portion of their architecture, and they contact us. it's almost always the case when by the time they contact us, there's done a lot more evaluation than you might be surprised. And they're contacting us because they're looking for advanced system design to hear the total story. Maybe they're ready to engage on a subscription. It can go any number of different ways. And that process takes us about 3 to 9 months with most customers. Sometimes it's up to 2 years. Sometimes it's shorter than that. Customers come with us. They come to kind of really two starting points. One starting point, which is the obvious one because we have a lot of different components, is they've already got an architecture. The architect is very confident that they've got the right design. And they're just shopping for certain components. I just need an API gateway or, I really need a message broker. And they're not shopping for anything else. And so they're comparison shopping us against the other open source components that they've come across. And it's kind of a best of breed sale. And that sort of sales process and sales cycle is very well structured. The requests are pretty standard. And we have lots of ways to service that with our sales and our solution architects and our partners. The other type of customers that come to us are customers that have broad business problems. They know that they want to build all kinds of services in the future. They know they need a broad integration backbone. They don't necessarily know what the best architecture is yet, and they're looking for us on a consultative basis. And in that situation, we spend a lot of time with either our partners or that account doing solution design, putting hypotheses together, you know, almost like an advertising agency where you have to say, here are, you know, 5 or 6 different ways you could approach these broad class of problems. And here's all the different configuration of either our technologies or other technologies out there that would let you deliver on that. And in that situation, it's a longer term sale. It's highly consultative. And if you do a good job on the consultative side, then they're usually more willing to pick our technology stack, get into a subscription with us, and sometimes even turns into a strategic relationship.
So it seems like for anybody in the enterprise integration business, the channel partners are going to be important. But I'm wondering, are there other types of partnerships that have also been important for WSO2 to grow the business?
There are really essential partnerships that happen in the open source realm in the ecosystem itself. Everybody's competitive to each other and everybody's complementary to each other now. And so it's really important to build key technology relationships with other vendors as a way to demonstrate confidence in the software that you're building there. And I think that WSO2 historically had kind of a very vertical stack of technology that it had built from the ground up. And so it hadn't done as much of that as some other companies do. But over the past couple of years, we've been shifting towards more of that. And, you know, there are important relationships that we've got budding with vendors like Red Hat and Pivotal, which are on one hand, both complementary to us and competitive at the same time. And so those are pretty essential. We call those technology partnerships to go alongside the channel partnerships that we got.
You have a 10-year product patch lifecycle, which is really long. How far ahead do you look? Do you look 20 years ahead in the future? Or another way I could ask the question is, where do you see WSO2 in the next 20 years?
Oh, well, you know, what I will say to that is the company's raised $45 million over its years. And for the first 12 years of its life, it was not profitable and cash flow positive. And so I think that when a company is going through that sort of phase, it's, you know, searching out product market fit. And when you're looking for product market fit and you've got a cash runway, you're kind of forced into a horizon, which is somewhat tailored to your cash position along the way. Although really good founders will look way beyond that. With the company now cash flow positive and profitable, it completely changes our horizon. And I think we think of things and probably we like to think of them as 10-year horizons, but although the pace of technology is moving so fast that 10 years just really, you know, kind of shocks the hell out of me. But we certainly are making bets that I'd be surprised if we don't see any revenue. It's going to take us 3 to 5 years before we see revenue on some of those bets. And it's really refreshing to be in a position where you can take those sorts of risks on as a company while still supporting your existing customers. And for us, I mean, I think the biggest shift is all of integration over the past 40 years has been centrally done, center of excellence, a big iron middleware, and that's even our classic stack. But that's shifting towards a completely distributed, decentralized mode driven by containers and Kubernetes. And so we're just kind of over the moon tickled because we get to take all this domain expertise that we've got, but we're basically throwing a lot of stuff out the door and saying, if we had to re-envision all this stuff from a developer-first, code-first, decentralized-first point of view, how would you make it all work? And you just approach things very differently. So we've got about 100 employees working on things that I would say related to this sort of theme. And I really don't anticipate seeing revenues from any of those things before 2020, maybe 2021. I mean, it's that sort of horizon that you got to be playing with.
My last question is, any advice for new entrepreneurs about launching a business around open source software?
Well, if you've already made the decision to go open source and now you're creating a business around that, be reflective of what are the principles and values for why you open sourced it in the first place. You need to hold true to that and find a business model that allows you to not compromise on those elements that's there. I think that's really important here. And then the other thing is to recognize that take it one step at a time. Businesses are not built overnight. They're built over a very long horizon. And you just need to have a mindset of just keep taking one step forward. And as long as you keep doing that, things will work out.
Tyler, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and experience today.
This was a real pleasure for me, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Transcription and episode audio can be found on opensourceunderdogs.com. Music from Broke for Free and Chris Zabriskie. Audio editing by Inez Zatenji. Production assistance and transcription by Natalie Lau. Operational support from William Lau. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @FossPodcast. That's FOSS Podcast. Tune in next week for an interview with Ofer Bengal, CEO of Redis. Until then, thanks for listening.